First Break All the Rules, Disc 6.
Number 2. A Touching Story. Mary G. has fingers that are as strong and as firm as they appear, and powerful forearms. Standing up straight above you, she has shoulders that seem to stretch from wall to wall, and as she reaches back to twist her hair out of the way, you notice that her elbows are surprisingly rounded. Later, when she bears down on them, they feel as though they must be 6 inches across. It is a good feeling. Mary is a massage therapist, and she was born to touch. Other people's bodies fascinate me. When someone is lying in front of me, it's like their skin is transparent. I can see the bands of muscles stretched up and around their shoulder blades, across their back and down their legs. I can see where the muscles are pulled taut and where they are all scrunched up in an angry little knot. I can almost see the nerves, too. I sense that with one person they might like long strokes that pump the muscle and get the blood going. With someone else they might prefer shiatsu. That's a technique where you use pressure points on the body to stimulate the nerve endings and open up the whole nervous system. Everyone is different. 3 years after finishing her training, Mary found herself the most sought-after therapist at the exclusive Arizona health spa where she worked. The word had spread. If you want a massage that pummels and loosens and opens you up, but with no pain, you must schedule with Mary. Soon her employer decided to promote her to manage all of the massage therapists at the resort. This meant more money, more security, better benefits, and fewer appointments of her own. And she was miserable. I miss the intimacy. As a massage therapist, I stand in a room with another person for an hour or more, in silence, and look through their skin and see their pain and ease their pain. I come to love each one just a little bit. I love the immediate gratification of releasing someone's stress. They look different afterward, immediately afterward. Their skin looks brighter, their eyes are clearer, and I know it will last. It is a great feeling for me, and I hope for them. Mary wanted to get that feeling back, so she quit her job, moved to Los Angeles, and set up her own practice. Her appointment book is filled up, and once again, Mary gets to touch people every single day. Number 3. Mandy's Designer Story. We met Mandy back in Chapter 5. She is the manager of a department that designs logos and other images to drive a product's brand identity. She tells this story. I inherited this woman, a design consultant, called Janet. A design consultant has two responsibilities. First, to interact with the clients and find out their needs, and second, to manage the designers so that they deliver what the client wanted. Janet was very ambitious, very talented, but she wasn't performing either of these roles very well. She wasn't failing, but she wasn't a star either. And she was the kind of person who needed to be a star. She realized pretty quickly that I thought she was mediocre, so her attitude took a dive. She wouldn't tell me directly, but I got word from her best friend in the office that she wanted me to fire her so that she could collect unemployment. It pissed me off that she wouldn't come clean with me, but I was damned if I was going to let her manipulate me into firing her. I wanted her to be honest with herself about her feelings and her intentions. I wanted her to understand that in the end, she would be rewarded for her honesty. So I waited her out, and over a period of about 4 months, we started to talk. We discussed her performance, her strengths, her weaknesses, likes, dislikes, that kind of thing. I told her that it wasn't her fault she wasn't excelling in this role, but that together we would have to find a solution. Then one day it occurred to me that she should go back to school and become a designer herself. She was very curious about the business, very creative, and much preferred to do a job by herself. She played with the idea for a while, and then she acted on it. She enrolled at New York University, got her degree, and is now at a large advertising agency as a designer, and very successful. Janet wasn't a bad person. She had just picked the wrong career, and having started it, she didn't want to admit to herself that she had made a mistake. I helped her. With self-discovery as its energy source, great managers now paint this picture of a healthy career. Guided, perhaps by her choice of college major, perhaps by her family, perhaps by necessity, the employee selects her first role and jumps into the fray. In this first role, she is unsure of herself. She is unsure of her ability to perform, unsure of her talents and her non-talents. As she achieves certain levels of performance, she might then move into different roles, or she might simply grow within that first role. Either way, it is now her responsibility to look in the mirror and ask, "Do I thrill to this role? Did I seem to learn this role quickly? Am I good in this role? Does this role bring me strength and satisfaction? It is her responsibility to listen for the clues that this role plays to her talents. She might have started in sales, then moved into marketing. In this new role, does she like being further removed from the customer? Does she love dealing with the patterns and concepts inherent in marketing? Or does she miss the direct interaction and the knowledge that she and she alone made that sale? She might have started as a flight attendant and then moved into the training department. Does she like helping novice flight attendants grow? Or does she yearn for the drama and the challenge of winning over tired, nervous passengers? As she looks in the mirror, she learns. Each step is the chance to discover a little more about her talents and her non-talents. These discoveries guide her next step, and her next, and her next. Her career is no longer a blind hunt for marketable experiences and a breathless climb upward. It has become an increasingly refined series of choices as she narrows her focus toward that role or roles where her strengths, her skills, her knowledge, and her talents converge and resound. Deep down, most people probably know that self-discovery is important to the building of a healthy career. The difference lies in the way great managers use self-discovery. First, they give self-discovery a central role, making it an explicit expectation for each employee. Mike C., a manager in a courier company, describes how he turns self-discovery from a theoretical concept into a simple, practical demand. When someone joins the team, I tell him that one of our major goals in working together is to help him figure out who he is. I tell him to look in the mirror. And if he doesn't know how to do that, I tell him to use the Sunday night blues test. If he doesn't feel that little stab of depression on Sunday night, if he actually finds himself looking forward to the week, then he should stop and ask himself why. What is it about the role that he loves so much? Whatever he answers, he should scribble it down and make sure that he keeps it in mind when he chooses another role. If he does feel those Sunday night blues coming on every weekend, then it's not necessarily his fault. It's not some failing in him. But he does need to ask the same question, why? What does he need that his current role is not giving him? Again, he should bear his answer in mind as he looks for other places to work. Managers like Mike C. aren't suggesting that gaining varied experiences is a bad idea, simply that it is insufficient. They know that an employee will fail to find the roles that fit him if he spends his career gorging himself on skills and experiences while neglecting to look in the mirror, an approach to career building that is as likely to succeed as is trying to build a healthy body by popping vitamins and diet pills while neglecting to exercise. Second, these exemplary managers emphasize that the point of self-discovery is not to fix your non-talents. The point is not to identify and then fill in your skill gaps, as many human resources departments euphemistically describe it. In the spirit of the insight that you cannot put in what was left out, you can only draw out what was left in, the point of self-discovery is to learn about yourself so that you can capitalize on who you are. The point is to take control of your career, to make more informed decisions, and to gradually select roles that represent an increasingly good fit for your natural talents. Second, each session began with a brief review of past performance. The purpose of this was not to evaluate, you should do less of that, you should fix this. Rather, the purpose was to help the employee think in detail about her style and to spark a conversation about the talents and non-talents that created this style. After this review, the focus always shifted to the future and how the employee could use her style to be productive. Sometimes they would work together to identify the employee's path of least resistance toward her goals, but often the discussion would revolve around partnership. What talents did the manager bring that could complement the non-talents of the employee? During that convention trip, most of Martin P.'s conversations dealt with partnership. This guy is incredibly driven, incredibly goal-oriented, but he lacks strategic thinking. He has a hard time imagining what obstacles might get in his way as he plows ahead. I can help him here. I can play out alternative scenarios for him, and then we can put together contingency plans should any of these scenarios actually happen. Jeff H. gives a similar description. One of my salespeople knows all the tricks for getting her foot in the door and asking the right questions, but lacks creativity when it comes to pricing the deal. I'm pretty good at that. So when we meet, she tells me the players and the situation, and I tell her whether she should present a leasing option, a buyback option, a volume discount deal, or whatever. Third, great managers made a point of giving their feedback in private, one-on-one. The purpose of feedback is to help each individual to understand and build upon his natural strengths. You cannot do this in a group setting. This sounds obvious, but given today's preoccupation with teamwork, it is surprising how many managers forget the importance of spending time alone with each of their people. As Phil Jackson, the extraordinarily successful coach of the Chicago Bulls, observes, "I prefer to deal with the players on an individual basis. This helps strengthen my one-on-one connection with the players, who sometimes get neglected because we spend so much of our time together en masse. Meeting with players privately helps me stay in touch with who they are out of uniform." During the 1995 playoffs, for instance, Tony Kukoc was troubled by reports that Split, Croatia, where his parents live, had been hit by a barrage of artillery fire. It took several days for him to get through on the phone and learn that his family was all right. The war in his homeland is a painful reality of Tony's life. If I ignored that, I probably wouldn't be able to relate to him on any but the most superficial level. Getting to know you. With descriptions like this, Phil helps provide an answer to the manager's age-old question, should you build close personal relationships with your employees, or does familiarity breed contempt? The most effective managers say yes, you should build personal relationships with your people, and no, familiarity does not breed contempt. This does not mean that you should necessarily become best friends with those who report to you, although if that is your style and if you keep them focused on performance outcomes, there is nothing wrong with doing so. The same applies to socializing with your people. If that is not your style, don't do it. If it is your style, then there is nothing damaging about having dinner or a drink with them, as long as you still evaluate them on performance outcomes. When great managers like Phil Jackson say they build close relationships with their people, when they say that familiarity does not breed contempt, they simply mean that a great manager must get to know his employees. And getting to know someone extends beyond a detailed understanding of an employee's talents and non-talents. It extends all the way to the practicalities and dramas of his personal life. The great manager does not necessarily have to intervene in the employee's life, although some do, but she does have to know about it, and she does have to care about it. During Gallup's 80,000 manager interviews, we ask this question. You have a talented employee who consistently shows up late for work. What would you say to this employee? The answers ranged from the authoritarian to the laissez-faire. I would fire him. We don't tolerate lateness here. I would give him a verbal warning, then a written warning, then fire him.
I would lock the door to the office and tell him that from now on, even if you are 2 seconds late, you won't be allowed in.
That's fine. I don't care what time they come in, as long as they stay late and get their work done.
Each of these responses is defensible. Each has its merits. But these were not the answers of great managers. When told that an employee was consistently showing up late for work, the great managers gave this one reply, which sums up their attitude toward manager-employee relationships. I would ask why. Maybe it has something to do with a bus schedule. Maybe he has to wait for a nanny to arrive. Maybe there is trouble at home. Once they had understood the employee's personal situation, they might take any number of different actions, ranging from changing the employee's hours to 10 to 6, to telling him to get the situation sorted out fast. But no matter what the next step, their first step was always to get to know the employee. Ask why. Phil Jackson's comments about personal relationships ends with this line. Athletes are not the most verbal breed. That's why bare attention and listening without judgment are so important. Great managers create a safety net. The conventional career path lacks forgiveness. As the employee climbs from rung to rung, the rungs are burned behind him. If he climbs onto a rung and struggles, he knows that his reputation will suffer and his job will be in jeopardy. There is no turning back. By punishing career missteps so severely, this path discourages everyone from taking bold career steps. In conventional wisdom's world, taking bold career steps in order to discover a latent talent or to refine an existing one is almost as foolhardy as volunteering to learn the trapeze without a safety net. No wonder people are so protective of their careers, so closed to their own feedback, so reluctant to change their career track based upon what they have discovered about themselves. This career path kills learning. Great managers want to encourage career learning. They want to promote active self-discovery. So they have devised their own makeshift career safety net, trial periods. Ellen P., the manager of in-flight training at Southwest Airlines, describes the safety net she built. "It is a big step for a flight attendant to move out of the planes and into the training room. Some people want to become a trainer because they will get to travel less. We knock those people out right away. But others talk about wanting to teach, wanting to pass on the tradition of Southwest. If we think they have the talent, and if we think they are seeking the job for the right reasons, then we bring them in for a 6-month trial period. We are very explicit that this is a time for them and for us to decide if this is really something that they will love to do for a long time. People don't realize that teaching is hard. We do teach ideas for having fun with the guests and playing games and telling jokes, but there is a lot of boring detail to communicate and a lot of rules for the students to learn. This trial period is a way for them to get a sense of how they like this kind of work. During the trial period, we sit down with them once a month and discuss their performance, what they are really enjoying, where they are struggling. We send other trainers in to evaluate them and give them feedback. And at the end of the 6 months, they have to pass certain tests to show that they have learned all the necessary information. Most do exactly that. And we now have a really talented group of trainers. But all of our trainees knew that if during the trial period, either they or the company felt that they were not a fit, they would have been able to go back to the planes and resume their flight attendant role. And that's happened a couple of times over the last few years. There was no shame in that, no failure. These people wanted to experiment, to learn if they could be a trainer. They took the step and learned that teaching was not for them. It worked out great for us, too. They are back on the planes now, focused on our guests, and undistracted by vague thoughts of moving into training. They have closed that door. They can move on. Trial periods are tricky. You must not use them as a substitute for selection. Like Ellen, you should use them only with people who have already shown some talent and some genuine interest in the role. After all, your main focus as a manager is not to help every employee play around within the company in the hope of finding something they like to do. Your main focus is to drive performance by matching the talent to the role. Even if an employee begs and pleads for a chance to discover a new talent, if you know he doesn't have it, don't offer him the trial period. Furthermore, if you use trial periods, then like Ellen, you must be very clear about the details. How long will it last? What criteria will you use to assess it? How often, if at all, will you meet during the trial period to discuss performance? Where will the employee go if she does not stay in the new role? You must answer all of these questions explicitly if the trial period is to be a success. Finally, and most significant, you must make it clear that the employee will be moved back into his previous role if either you or he is unhappy with the fit. This will avoid any unfortunate misunderstandings. The trial period is not just for his benefit, it is also for yours. If, after the trial period is over, he loves the role but you perceive a misfit, your assessment wins. He may not be happy with this, but at least he will not feel ambushed. The Art of Tough Love. How do great managers terminate someone and still keep the relationship intact? Whether the employee is at the end of a trial period or whether he is just struggling along in his current role, it is still difficult to bring him bad news. It is still difficult to tell him that he needs to move out of his role. During Gallup's interviews, many managers, both great and average, confessed that they were physically sick before each conversation of this kind. No matter how you approach it, no matter how accomplished you are as a manager, removing someone from his role is never easy. Here we are not referring to situations where the employee has committed some heinous or unethical act. With their quasi-legal or legal nature, these dramas are more clear-cut. Rather, we are referring to those unfortunate times when it becomes obvious that a particular employee is consistently failing to perform. Situations like this are much less well-defined. As a manager, you have many decisions to make. What level of performance is unacceptable? How long is too long at that level? Have you done enough to help with training, motivation, support systems, or complementary partnering? Should you break the news all at once, or should you give them a probationary period? When the final conversation happens, what words will you use? Some managers are so overwhelmed by these questions that they avoid the issue altogether. They take the easy way out and layer over the problem employee with a new hire. In the short run, this can appear to be a painless and convenient solution, but in the long run, like wrapping pristine bandages around an infected wound, it is deadly for the company.
Some managers solve the problem by deciding to keep all their employees at arm's length. With this neat trick, they hope to diminish the tension and the pain inherent in giving bad news to a friend. Unfortunately, as Phil Jackson pointed out, by refusing to get to know their employees, they also diminish the likelihood that they will ever be able to help any of these employees excel. The best managers do not resort to either of these evasive maneuvers. They don't have to. They employ tough love, which is not a technique or sequence of action steps, but a mindset, one that reconciles an uncompromising focus on excellence with a genuine need to care. It is a mindset that forces great managers to confront poor performance early and directly. Yet, it allows them to keep their relationship with the employee intact. So what is tough love? How does it work? The tough part is easy to explain. Because great managers use excellence as their frame of reference when assessing performance, tough love simply implies that they do not compromise on this standard. So, in answer to the question, what level of performance is unacceptable, these managers reply, any level that hovers around average with no trend upward. In answer to the question, how long at that level is too long, great managers reply, not very long. It was this uncompromising standard of excellence that drove Harry D., a successful manager of two car dealerships. We opened a second car dealership, much larger than the first. I wanted to create what I called a total service culture, where the customers received a seamless quality experience, whether they were dealing with the sales department, the financing department, or the service department. I was looking for total integration of systems and total cooperation from my department heads. Big plans, right? It got off to a rocky start, let me tell you. My biggest mistake was the guy I promoted to head up the sales department, Simon. He came from my smaller dealership, where he was sales manager, very successful. But when he moved into the new spot, he couldn't get into the cooperation thing at all. He wouldn't communicate with the other department heads. He wouldn't show up for meetings. He wouldn't sit down with the other department heads and work out how to integrate the systems and ease the interdepartmental handoffs so that the customer wouldn't feel a jolt. He was just interested in his guys and his numbers. At the same time, back at the other dealership, I had stupidly promoted one of the salespeople to sales manager, and he was struggling too. So I had grown from one success to two failures. Not bad going. I knew I had to move quickly. I had talked with Simon about my concerns a couple of times, but saw no improvement at all. So, 5 months in, I pulled him into my office and told him that I wanted him back in the other dealership. I told him that in this new dealership I was not interested simply in sales numbers, that I wanted to build this integrated total service experience, and that he wasn't helping. I told him that he was a loner and that back in the other dealership he could narrow his focus all he wanted, but here in the new world it wouldn't fly. "I'm sending you back," I said. He was so pissed off he looked like he was going to punch me. "You haven't given me enough time. You gotta let me have another shot," all that kind of stuff. But I know my people, sometimes better than they know themselves. I knew that Simon wasn't a team person. I knew that he would never be able to build the total experience I wanted. Better to pull the trigger now, I thought, rather than letting things drag on with him beginning to feel more invested and me getting more disappointed. Now he's doing extremely well back at the smaller place, and I managed to find a collaborative sales manager for this place. My brave new world is coming along nicely. Harry is universally loved by his employees. He is a pushover when employees need to change their hours, take a day off, or shortcut a process for the sake of the customer. But he is rock solid when it comes to excellence. As he says, "Excellence is my thing. If you don't like it, that's fine. Just don't come to work here." The love element of tough love is a little subtler. This element still forces managers to confront poor performance early, but allows them to do so in such a way that much of the bitterness and the ill will disappear. And it all springs from the concept of talent. An understanding of talent, an understanding that each person possesses enduring patterns of thought, feeling, and behavior, is incredibly liberating when managers have to confront poor performance. Why? Because it frees the manager from blaming the employee. Consider the manager who believes that with enough willpower and determination, virtually all behaviors can be changed. For this manager, every case of poor performance is the employee's fault. The employee has been warned repeatedly, and still he has not improved his performance. If he had more drive, more spirit, more willingness to learn, he would have changed his behavior as required, and the poor performance would have disappeared. But it hasn't disappeared. He must not be trying hard enough. It is his fault. This seductive logic puts this manager in a very awkward position. Since she told the employee what to do, and since it wasn't done, then the employee must be weak-willed, stupid, disobedient, or disrespectful. How can you have a constructive conversation with someone when beneath the surface politeness, this is what you are compelled to think of him? It's hard. If you are by nature an emotional manager, you fear you might lose your temper and let your anger show. If you are by nature a caring and supportive manager, you worry that he might see through your soothing words and realize how deeply disappointed you are in him. Whatever your style, a conversation where you have to mask your true feelings is a stressful conversation, particularly when your feelings are so negative. No wonder so many managers try to avoid it. But great managers don't have to hide their true feelings. They understand that a person's talent and non-talent constitute an enduring pattern. They know that if, after pulling out all the stops to manage around his non-talents, an employee still underperforms, the most likely explanation is that his talents do not match his role. In the minds of great managers, consistent poor performance is not primarily a matter of weakness, stupidity, disobedience, or disrespect. It is a matter of miscasting. If there is blame here, it is evenly spread. Perhaps the employee should have been more self-aware. Perhaps the manager should have been more perceptive. Perhaps. But this is just hindsight pointing the finger. No employee will ever be completely self-aware. No manager will ever know each of his people perfectly, even if he has selected very carefully for talent. So casting errors are not cause for anger or recrimination. Casting errors are inevitable. When an employee is obviously miscast, great managers hold up the mirror. They encourage the employee to use this misstep to learn a little more about his unique combination of talents and non-talents. They use language like, "This isn't a fit for you. Let's talk about why." Or, "You need to find a role that plays more to your natural strengths. What do you think that role might be?" They use this language not because it is polite, not because it softens the bad news, but because it is true. This is the love element of tough love. The most effective managers do genuinely care about each of their people, but they imbue care with a distinct meaning. In their minds, to care means to set the person up for success. They truly want each person to find roles where he has a chance to excel, and they know that this is possible only in roles that play to his talents. By this definition, if the person is struggling, it is actively uncaring to allow him to keep playing a part that doesn't fit. By this definition, firing the person is a caring act. This definition explains not only why great managers move fast to confront poor performance, but also why they are adept at keeping the relationship intact while doing so. All in all, the tough love mindset enables a great manager to keep two contradictory thoughts in mind at the same time, the need to maintain high performance standards and the need to care, and still function effectively. Tough love enables Mike H., an IT executive, to say in the same breath, "I've never fired someone too early," and "I truly care about helping my people be successful." Tough love allows John F., a manufacturing supervisor, to reminisce, "I have fired a few people in my time, but I've stayed close to them. Now that I think about it, each of the best men at my two weddings was someone I had previously fired." Tough love explains the incongruous nature of Gary L.'s conversation. Gary, an enormously successful entrepreneur, 6-time winner of the Queen's Award for Industry, brought in one of his factory managers one evening and told him, "Come in, sit down. I love you. You're fired. I still love you. Now, get a drink and let's talk this through." Manager-assisted career suicide. Tough love is a powerful mindset, providing a coherent rationale and a simple language for handling a delicate situation. But if you choose to incorporate it into your own management style, remember, counseling a person out of a role is and will always be a delicate situation. Tough love is helpful, but will never make it easy. Harry D., the car dealer, captures one of the constant difficulties perfectly with his comment, "But I know my people, sometimes better than they know themselves." In the tough love approach, the manager often has to confront the employee with truths that the employee may not be ready to hear. This will always be a subtle negotiation. That is why you need to get to know your people so well, why you need to meet with them so regularly, why your rationale needs to be clear and your language consistent. Some may complain that even if you do all of these things, you still don't have the right to believe that you know the person better than he does himself.
great managers disagree. When Gallup asked, "Would you rather get employees what they want, or would you rather get them what is right for them?" the great managers consistently replied, "Get them what is right for them." This sounds authoritarian, even arrogant, but Martin P., the police chief, makes a compelling point.
"I believe that deep down, the poor performer knows he is struggling before you do. Maybe he can't find the words, or maybe his pride won't let him say it, but he knows. On some level, he wants your help. And so, subconsciously, he puts himself in situations where his weaknesses are exposed. He is daring you, pushing you to fire him. I call this manager-assisted career suicide. If you suspect that this is happening, the best thing you can do is help put him out of his misery. I had one police officer, Max, who couldn't handle confrontation. Imagine, as an officer, you meet the worst people, and you meet the best people on their worst days. You get shouted at verbally and sometimes physically abused. You have to keep your cool under all of these conditions. Max couldn't. He would become frustrated, angry, rude. We had reports of an occasional use of profanity. These are low-level disciplinary matters that are brought before a tribunal. I would sit in on these meetings and read the reports, and Max would deny them, vigorously. Very vigorously. I saw exactly the kinds of behaviors in these meetings that citizens were complaining about. We gave him behavioral counseling, and he worked on it, but it was such a basic part of his personality. He kept going out on patrol, he kept losing his cool, and he kept denying it in the tribunals. He was committing manager-assisted career suicide. He wanted me to fire him. It was his only way out. So I did. I removed him from the department. He was a good person, with the wrong demeanor for a police officer. Through our outplacement service, he found a role as a claims adjuster for an insurance agency here in town, which fits his character so much better. I'm still in touch with him, still friendly, and more important, he is doing very well. Many of the great managers we interviewed echoed the themes in Martin's story. The employee refused to confront the truth of his situation, and so was angry at the time, but months, and sometimes years later, the employee would make a call or write a letter or walk up to the manager in an airport to tell him, "Thank you. I didn't realize it then, but moving me out of that job was one of the best things anyone has ever done for me." It doesn't always happen this way. Some employees remain bitter to the end. But tough love does provide a way for the manager and the employee to handle this delicate situation with dignity. Tough love keeps everyone whole. Chapter 7. Turning the Keys, A Practical Guide. The Art of Interviewing for Talent. Performance Management. Keys of Your Own. Master Keys. Every great manager has his or her own style, but every great manager shares the same goal, to turn each employee's talent into performance. The four keys, select for talent, define the right outcomes, focus on strengths, find the right fit, reveal how they attack this goal. In the previous four chapters, we described the four keys, how each works, and why each is important to the challenge of turning talent into performance. Now, in this chapter, we will describe what you can do to turn each of these keys. Bear in mind that these keys are not steps. They are not a structured series of actions intruding on your natural style. Rather, each key is simply a way of thinking, a new perspective on a familiar set of challenges. As we mentioned in the introduction, our purpose is to help you capitalize on your style by showing you how great managers think, not to replace your style with a standardized version of theirs. We are not suggesting that you incorporate every single one of these actions into your style. These techniques simply represent a cross-section of ideas gleaned from thousands of different managers. No one manager embodies them all. We suggest you pick and choose from these actions, refine them, improve them, and fashion them into a form that fits you. The Art of Interviewing for Talent. Which are the right questions to ask? 1. Make sure the talent interview stands alone. Recruiting can be a complicated process. The candidate has to learn about you, the company, the role, and the details of his compensation. You have to check his resume, make him an offer. He may counter, you then resubmit your offer, and so the negotiating continues until finally you both feel comfortable enough to commit. This process is important, but all of it should be handled separately from the talent interview. The talent interview should stand alone. It has but one purpose.
to discover whether the candidate's recurring patterns of thought, feeling, or behavior match the job. This is difficult enough without trying to accomplish everything else simultaneously. So, set aside a defined amount of time where both you and the candidate know that the exclusive goal is to learn about his talents. Let him know that the interview will be a little different from other interviews. It will be more structured, more focused, less banter, more questions. 2. Ask a few open-ended questions, and then try to keep quiet. The best way to discover a person's talents in an interview is to allow him to reveal himself by the choices he makes. In a sense, the talent interview should mirror verbally what will face him on the job behaviorally. On the job, he will face thousands of situations every day to which he could respond in any number of ways. How he consistently responds will be his performance. So, in the interview, ask open-ended questions that offer many potential directions and do not telegraph the right direction. Questions such as, "How closely do you think people should be supervised?" or "What do you enjoy most about selling?" The direction he takes spontaneously will be most predictive of his future behaviors. When you have asked a question, it is best to pause and remain silent. If he asks you to explain what you mean, deflect his question. Tell him that you are really more interested in what he means. Say that it is his interpretation that is important. Let him answer your questions as his filter dictates. Let him reveal himself to you. Most important, when he answers, believe him. No matter how much you might like his first impression, if you ask him how important it is to be the best and he replies, "Well, I like to be the best, but mostly I just try to be the best I can be," believe him. If you ask him what he likes about selling and he keeps talking about how quickly he wants to move into management, believe him. If you ask him what he loves about teaching and he never mentions children, believe him. Whatever he says, believe him. A person's unaided response to an open-ended question is powerfully predictive. Trust it, no matter how much you might want to hear something else. 3. Listen for specifics. Past behavior is a good predictor of future behavior. Therefore, questions like, "Tell me about a time when you," can serve you well. But be careful with these "tell me about a time" questions. First, you should always be listening for a specific example. And by specific, we mean specific by time, by person, or by event. In this way, you will avoid giving credit to the person who rattles off a whole paragraph of theory about how important something is, but who never actually recounts a specific time when she did it. Second, give credit only to the person's top-of-mind response. Past behavior is predictive of future behavior only if the past behavior is recurring. If behavior does indeed happen a lot, then the person should be able to come up with a specific example with only one prompt. If he can, then it gives you a clue that this behavior is a recurring part of his life. For example, let's say you are selecting for a sales position and you have decided to include the relating talent, assertiveness, in your talent profile. You might ask a question like, "Tell me about a time when you overcame resistance to your ideas." Notice that you haven't asked for a specific. You have simply asked the individual to tell you about a time when it happened. However, you are now listening for a specific. Here are two of the infinite number of possible answers. 1. I think it is very important to be persistent, particularly if you really believe in your ideas. We really encourage that kind of candor here. With my team, if I have a suggestion that others disagree with, I know they will expect me to keep supporting my idea until somebody comes up with a better one. In fact, it happens all the time. 2. It happened yesterday. Which is the better answer? Well, it is hard to say which is better, but 2 is certainly the more predictive answer. Here the candidate spontaneously gave you an example that was specific by time, yesterday. You don't know exactly what happened, but who cares? The details are less important than the top-of-mind specificity. You didn't ask for a specific, but with only one prompt, "Tell me about a time," he gave you a specific. Although you must ask many more questions to gain a fuller picture of his talent, his answer here is a first clue that this behavior, supporting his ideas in the face of resistance, is a recurring part of his life. By contrast, in 1, the candidate gave you a nice little description of why she thought it was important to be candid, and then claimed that it happens all the time. There's nothing wrong with this answer, but lacking any specifics, there is nothing predictive about it either. Faced with answers like 1, some managers are tempted to probe,
Can you tell me more about that? Can you tell me what happened? They then judge the answer on the quality of the person's example. How much detail did she provide? How articulate was she? Do I agree with what she said she did? This is a cardinal sin of interviewing. Regardless of the detail the candidate eventually provided, if she needed two or three probes to describe a specific example, then the chances are that the behavior in question is not a recurring part of her life. When you ask, "Tell me about a time," questions, don't judge the response on the quality of its detail. If you do, you will end up evaluating whether the person is articulate or whether the person has a good memory, rather than whether he or she has the particular recurring talent you want. Instead, judge the response on whether it was specific and top of mind. Of course, with either one or two, if you want to ask more questions to satisfy your own curiosity, go ahead. But remember, even if she eventually provides you with a detailed example, the fact that she required two or three probes to dredge it up tells you that the behavior is not a recurring part of her life. 4. Clues to talent. Aside from specific examples of past behavior, what else should you be listening for? Are there any other signs that can tip you off that the candidate does indeed possess the talents you are looking for? Over the years, we have found many small clues to a person's talent. A sudden glimpse of excellence at the role, a yearning towards certain activities, a feeling of flow while performing the activity. Of all these clues, two might be useful to you during the talent interview. Each person is so complex that no interviewing or testing system will ever be able to define his profile of talents perfectly. However, if you focus your questions toward these clues, then, like an image on a fresh Polaroid, the person's most dominant talents should gradually emerge. You can then compare his talents to those in your desired profile and assess the match. A. Rapid learning. When you learn a new role, you tend to learn it in terms of steps. Sometimes the steps stay with you no matter how hard you practice. For example, you may have been giving presentations for years, but you still struggle. Every time you have to present, you revert back to the three basic steps you remember from public speaking class. Okay, first I must tell them what I am going to tell them, then I must tell them, then I must tell them what I just told them. But with other activities, the steps just seem to fall away. You feel a sense of gliding, of smoothness. For example, after a couple of months as a salesperson, you may have begun to feel this smoothness. All of a sudden, you seem to be able to see inside the mind of the prospect, and you knew almost instinctively what words to say next. Or perhaps as a student teacher, after your initial nervousness had faded, the names of the children came easily, and you found yourself walking up and down the rows of desks as if you had been teaching all of your life. When you have this feeling, it is as if the steps of the new role are simply giving form to a mental pattern already grooved within you, which, if you think about it, they are. Rapid learning is an important clue to a person's talent. Ask the candidate what kinds of roles she has been able to learn quickly. Ask her what activities come easily to her now. She will give you more clues to her talent. B. Satisfactions. Everyone breathes different psychological oxygen. What is fulfilling for one person is asphyxiating for another. Great accountants love the fact that 2 plus 2 equals 4 every time they do it. Great salespeople get a kick out of turning a no into a yes. Great flight attendants gravitate toward the tired, angry business traveler or the boisterous school sports team at the back because they enjoy turning around the tough customers. A person's sources of satisfaction are clues to his talent. So ask him what his greatest personal satisfaction is. Ask him what kinds of situations give him strength. Ask him what he finds fulfilling. His answers will help you know what he will be able to keep doing week after week after week. 5. Know what to listen for. Many managers have a list of favorite questions they resort to every time they interview someone. So do great managers, but with one important distinction. They ask only questions where they know how top performers respond. In their mind, the question is not nearly as important as knowing how the best answer. For example, here is a question that can identify the different striving talents of salespeople and teachers. How do you feel when someone doubts what you have to say? You might think that the best salespeople would say they like a little doubting, that it would give them a chance to show just how persuasive they could be. Surprisingly, they don't. They report that they hate it. It upsets them to be doubted, although they may not show it, because, as we described earlier, great salespeople are selling themselves. To doubt them is to question their personal integrity. Disagree with them, argue with them, choose not to buy from them, but don't doubt them. Average salespeople are not personally invested. They don't mind being doubted, so this question doesn't strike any emotional chord with them at all. For sales managers, then, this has proved to be a good question, because what they listen for is upset. Of course, this isn't the only question great sales managers ask. As we described earlier, the worst salespeople are also upset by rejection. Managers must ask further questions, how questions and who questions, to discover whether the candidate possesses other vital sales talents, like innate assertiveness or a love of breaking the ice with people. By contrast, it turns out that great teachers say they love being doubted. They cherish those moments. Great teachers instinctively interpret the doubters as students, and they see this doubting as a sign of an active, inquisitive mind. For great teachers, then, doubting means learning. Conversely, average teachers say they don't like to be doubted. Their first point of reference is their own competence, not the student's learning. Being doubted means having their competence challenged, and for them, there is nothing worse. This question works well for selecting teachers, then, but only if the desired response is, "I love it." The question doesn't work at all if you are selecting nurses. Why? Because the best nurses do not answer in a way that is consistent with each other and different from their less successful colleagues. When you think about it, this is hardly surprising. After all, on those rare occasions when a nurse is doubted, how she reacts to the doubting probably has little to do with how good a nurse she is overall. How can you develop these question-listen-for combinations? First, you can try out a question on a few of your best employees and a few of the rest, and then see if the best answer differently, consistently. If they do, the question-listen-for combination is a good one. If they don't, as with nurses and the doubting question, then the question might not be worth asking. Second, you can ask the question of all new applicants. Write down what they say and keep a record of it. After they have been hired, check back to see if the people who subsequently performed well answered your question in a consistent way. This takes time and focus, but as with any art, time and focus are required to cultivate the art of interviewing for talent. The concept of talent applies to all that great managers do. However, the activity of selecting for talent is separate. It occurs at the time that you make the hiring decision. The activities of the other three keys, define the right outcomes, focus on strengths, and find the right fit, cannot be separated so easily. How you set expectations for someone is interwoven with the way you motivate him to achieve those expectations. How you motivate and encourage him is often part of a broader conversation where you are also helping him find the right fit. The day-to-day challenge of turning talent into performance involves the turning of all three keys, all at once, all the time. Performance management. How do great managers turn the three keys every day? The example is given by Ryu, who tried to get actual work done. They met this challenge by forming a routine, a performance management routine. This routine of meetings and conversations forced them to keep focused on the progress of each person's performance, even though many other business demands were competing for their attention. Each manager's routine was different, reflecting his or her unique style. Nonetheless, hidden within this diversity, we found four characteristics common to the performance management routines of great managers. First, the routine is simple. Great managers dislike the complexity of most company-sponsored performance appraisal schemes. They don't want to waste their time trying to decide for the alien term and to fill out bureaucratic forms. Instead, they prefer a simple form that allows them to concentrate on the difficult tasks we make. Between a manager and the employer. Once a year, twice a year, does like a giant employee. Seek to help employee excel his details, the details of his particular recognition needs, his relationship needs, and goals, and of his talents and non-talents. The yearly meeting misses these details. It degenerates in discussion about potential opportunities for improvement. The only way to capture the detail is to meet at a minimum once a quarter, sometimes more easily. At these meetings, the specifics of success or disappointment are out of memory. The employee can tell how a particular interaction is being. The manager can recall the meeting, subtle changes or a different way of interpreting this event. The conversation can be vivid, the advice practical. Furthermore, in the intervening weeks between meetings, the manager and the employee are motivated to concentrate on events as they occur, because each knows that a forum for discussing these events will soon arise. Frequent performance meetings force both manager and employee to pay attention. If you are worried about the time drain inherent in frequent performance meetings, remember that the best managers spend, on average, only 1 hour per quarter per person discussing performance. Furthermore, frequent performance meetings make it so much easier to raise the always sensitive subject of the employee's areas of poor performance. If you meet only once or twice a year, you are forced to drop your criticisms on the employee all at once, like a bomb. When the employee inevitably recoils, then you have to dredge your memory for examples to support your argument. But by meeting frequently, you can avoid this battle of wills. You can introduce areas of poor performance little by little over time, and each time you raise the subject, you can refer to recent, vivid examples. Your criticisms will be easier to swallow, and the conversation more productive. Third, the routine is focused on the future. Great managers do use a review of past performance to highlight discoveries about the person's style or needs. However, their natural inclination is to focus on the future. They want to discuss what could be, rather than allowing the conversation to descend into recriminations and postmortems that lead nowhere. Therefore, while the first 10 minutes of the meeting may be used for review, the rest of the time is devoted to the truly creative work. What do you want to accomplish in the next few months? What measuring sticks will we use? What is your most efficient route toward those goals? How can I help? In their view, these kinds of conversations are more energetic, more productive, and more satisfying. Last, the routine asks the employee to keep track of his own performance and learnings. In many companies, performance appraisal is something that happens to an employee. She is a passive observer, waiting to receive the judgment of her manager. If she is lucky, she may be asked to rate herself before she sees how the company rates her. But even here, she is still reactive. She knows that the purpose of her self-assessment is to serve as a counterpoint or comparison with the assessment of her manager. So her self-assessment becomes a negotiating tool. I'll pitch mine high and will probably end up some rather than evaluation. The best managers reject this. They want a routine that asks each employee to keep track of her own performance and learnings. They want her to write down her goals, her successes, and her discoveries. This record is not designed to be evaluated or critiqued by her manager. Rather, its purpose is to help each employee take responsibility for her performance. It serves as her mirror. It is a way to step outside herself. Using this record, she can see how she plans to affect the world. She can weigh the effect of those plans. She can be accountable to herself. Naturally, great managers want to discuss and agree to each employee's short-term performance goals, but the rest of the record, her discoveries about herself, the descriptions of new skills she has learned, the letters of recognition she may have received, are part of a private document. If the employee is fortunate enough to have a trusting relationship with her manager, she may feel comfortable sharing the whole record, successes, failures, perceived strengths. But this is not the point of it. The point is to encourage the employee to keep track of her own performance and learnings. The point is self-discovery. Recent research into adult learning reveals that students stay in school longer and learn more if they are expected to direct and record their progress. Great managers realized this long ago and now apply it with their employees. These four characteristics, simplicity, frequent interaction, focus on the future, and self-tracking, are the foundation for a successful performance management routine. In the basic routine below, we describe some of the questions many great managers ask to learn about their employees and the format they usually follow. Our purpose is not to tell you exactly what to say or how to say it or to whom, because that would be cumbersome and artificial. You will, of course, want to adapt the questions and tools to your own talent and experience. However, if you follow this basic routine and incorporate it successfully into your own style, you will give yourself the best chance possible to define the right outcomes,
to focus on strengths and to help each person find the right fit. The basic routine. The strengths interview. At the beginning of each year, or a week or two after the person has been hired, spend about an hour with them asking the following 10 questions. Question 1. What did you enjoy most about your previous work experience? What brought you here? If an existing employee, what keeps you here? Question 2. What do you think your strengths are? Skills, knowledge, talent. Question 3. What about your weaknesses? Question 4. What are your goals for your current role? Ask for scores and timelines. Question 5. How often do you like to meet with me to discuss your progress? Are you the kind of person who will tell me how you are feeling, or will I have to ask? Question 6. Do you have any personal goals or commitment you would like to tell me about? Question 7. What is the best praise you have ever received? What made it so good? Question 8. Have you had any really productive partnerships or mentors? Why do you think these relationships worked so well for you? Question 9. What are your future growth goals, your career goals? Are there any particular skills you want to learn? Are there some specific challenges you want to experience? How can I help? Question 10. Is there anything else you want to talk about that might help us work well together? The main purpose of this session is to learn about his strengths, his goals, and his needs as he perceives them. Whatever he says, even if you disagree with him, jot it down. If you want to help him be productive, you have to know where he is starting from. His answers will tell you where he thinks he is. During the course of the year, it may be appropriate to help him change his opinions, but initially you are interested in seeing his world through his eyes. During the course of the strengths interview, he will tell you how often he wants to meet to discuss his progress with you. Question 5. Schedule the first performance planning meeting of the year at the interval he indicated. For the purposes of this description, we will assume he said once every 3 months. The performance planning meetings. To help him prepare, ask him to write down answers to these 3 questions before each meeting. A. What actions have you taken? These should be the details of his performance over the last 3 months. He should include scores, rankings, ratings, and timelines if available. B. What discoveries have you made? These discoveries might be in the form of training classes he attended, or they might simply be new insights derived from an internal presentation he made, or a job shadowing session in which he participated, or even a book that he read. Wherever they came from, encourage him to keep track of his own learning. C. What partnerships have you built? These partnerships are the relationships he has formed. They might be new relationships or the strengthening of existing relationships. They might be relationships with colleagues or clients, professional relationships, or personal ones. It is up to him to decide. Whatever he decides, it is important that he take responsibility for building his constituency inside and outside the company. At the beginning of the meeting, ask him A, B, and C. Jot down his answers and keep a copy. He should keep his written copy. If he wants to share all of his written answers with you, wonderful, but don't demand it. Either way, use his answers as a jumping-off point to discuss his performance over the last 3 months. After about 10 minutes, direct the conversation toward the future, drawing on the following questions. D. What is your main focus? What is his primary goal or goals for the next 3 months? E. What new discoveries are you planning? What specific discoveries is he hoping to make over the next 3 months? F. What new partnerships are you hoping to build? How is he planning to grow his constituency over the next 3 months? Terms such as discovery or partnership may not fit your style or your company's culture. You will know the right words to choose. But whatever your word choices, make sure that your conversation about his next 3 months extends beyond simple achievement goals. Suggest that he write down his answers. You should discuss his answers, agree to them, and then keep your copy. His answers will now serve as your specific expectations of him for the next 3 months. After another 3 months have elapsed, ask him to write down his answers to A, B, and C, and once again, at your second performance planning meeting, ask him these 3 questions and use his answers to spur discussion about his performance. Then quickly move into a discussion about the future and ask him D, E, and F. Once again, it will be helpful if you and he write down what he says and keep copies. As you talk through his successes, his struggles, and his goals, try to keep focusing on his strengths by setting expectations that are right for him, by helping him to perfect his style, and by discussing how you can run interference for him. Repeat this routine at the next 3-month interval, and the next, until the year cycle is complete. By the end of the year, you will have met at least 4 times. You will have reviewed his past and planned in detail his future progress. You will have learned more about his idiosyncrasies and, perhaps, have used what you learned to help him identify his true strengths and weaknesses more accurately. Perhaps he will have changed his mind about some of his opinions and some of his needs. You will have been close to him through some difficult times and through some successes. You will have disagreed on some things and agreed on much. But whatever happens, you will now be stronger partners. By meeting frequently, by listening, by paying attention, by advising, and by planning in detail, you will have developed a shared and realistic interest in his success. And important, he will have a record of it all. Career discovery questions. At some point during your performance planning meetings, the employee may want to talk about his career options. He may want to know where you think he should go next. A healthy career discussion rarely happens all at once. Instead, it is a product of many different conversations at many different times. However you choose to handle these conversations, and each will be unique according to the potential and the performance of the individual employee, you need to ensure that, over time, 2 things happen. First, the employee needs to become increasingly clear about his skills, knowledge, and talents. Lacking this kind of clarity, he will be a poor partner as you and he together plan out his next career steps. Second, he needs to understand in detail what this next step would entail and why he thinks he would excel at it. He must come to these understandings by himself. But you can help. You can use these 5 career discovery questions at different times to prompt his thinking. Question 1. How would you describe success in your current role? Can you measure it? Here is what I think. Add your own comments. Question 2. What do you actually do that makes you as good as you are? What does this tell you about your skills, knowledge, and talents? Here is what I think. Add your own comments. Question 3. Which part of your current role do you enjoy the most? Why? Question 4. Which part of your current role are you struggling with? What does this tell you about your skills, knowledge, and talent? What can we do to manage around this? Training, positioning, support system, partnering. Question 5. What would be the perfect role for you? Imagine you are in that role. It's 3 p.m. on a Thursday. What are you doing? Why would you like it so much? Here is what I think. Add your own comments. These questions, scattered throughout the year, will function as cues to get the employee thinking in detail about his performance. Does he want to build his career by growing within his current role? Does he want to move into a new role? If so, what strength and satisfaction would he derive from it? These 5 questions won't necessarily provide the answers, but asked in the right way, at the right time, they will help the employee focus his thoughts, and he will come to know your thoughts. Together, you will form a few firm conclusions about his present performance and his potential. Together, you will now make better decisions about his future.
This ends Disc 6.